How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, focused on the investment risks and opportunities arising from the transition to a more sustainable global economy and helping clients invest in climate change solutions. ImpaxAM.com/invest.
I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to the Marketplace Tech Special, How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change. The effects of climate change are more obvious every day. Record-breaking heat, extreme storms, devastating drought and wildfire, catastrophic flooding. And as the world reckons with how to slow the warming that's driving this changing weather, we're also figuring out how to adapt to it, how to survive it. Adaptation, also called resilience in the climate world, has been a relatively small part of the climate conversation. One study from a think tank called the Climate Policy Initiative estimates that we spent $30 billion on climate adaptation from 2017 to 2018. But experts say we should be spending a lot more, specifically $180 billion every year over the next decade on solutions like early warning systems for floods and storms, more resilient homes and buildings and infrastructure, managing water, creating more resilient crops. All of that, says the Global Commission on Adaptation, would result in more than $7 trillion in benefits. And that investment is starting. Much like the pandemic changed the way we live around the world, climate change is forcing us to change how we think about a new reality of extreme weather and changing landscapes. Over the next hour, we'll look at how people are adapting to wildfire, flooding, and drought, how companies are coming up with tech innovations to make people more resilient, how startups are reinventing finance and business models for a new world of climate, and how established companies and industries are changing faster than they ever imagined. Adaptation is, first and foremost, a mindset, and people are thinking differently. The people who can afford to are, in some cases, making major changes to their homes and their lives. They're buying generators and solar-powered batteries to keep the lights on when the power goes out. They're installing air conditioning in parts of the country that didn't used to get so hot. They're shopping for houses that are farther away from sea level rise, and they're trying to make their homes more resilient. Brian Rankin owns a place right on a creek on Maryland's eastern shore. It was built in the 60s and flooded during Hurricane Isabel in 2003. He bought the house in 2015, but could see evidence of the flood.
Where the plywood was stained, you know, is much, much darker.
Rankin renovated the home with surviving future floods in mind. The problem, he says, isn't just water coming in. It's what happens when the water tries to leave and gets stuck.
If there's water trapped in the house or the foundation, that's when you can have problems. So we installed smart vents that as the water recedes, they open up and let the water out of the house.
The vents weren't cheap. They cost over $1,000 altogether. Rankin also installed chemical insulation in the house because the pink fluffy stuff would be ruined if there was a flood.
The electrical is installed 3 feet above the ground floor. I mean, switches are normally that high anyway, but on the ground floor, all the electrical outlets are above that. So in case it flooded, it wouldn't short out.
He thought about even more radical adaptations, like a 4-foot wall around the property to keep the water out completely.
My wife thinks it's a good idea. I haven't thought about it because it would be like an astronomical expense. But I mean, you think about it.
And when the hurricanes do come, the Rankins just move stuff. This summer, when they thought Hurricane Isaias might hit the home, they moved all the mattresses, pillows, and papers to higher floors.
And then you get tired, and it's like, oh, I should move that too, but I'm too tired. I've been doing this all day. This thing I can let go.
Brian Rankin in Kent County, Maryland. Now, some adaptations are pretty practical, like the Rankins. You don't think about how you're adapting to climate change. You're just getting necessities for a new normal. For some, though, as reality sinks in, like extended fire seasons and smoky air in the American West, it's just too much to take. Keith Helfrich lives in San Francisco, California. Like the Rankins, he started out with small adaptations around the house. He bought an air filtration system and a water distillation machine to improve the quality of the water he uses. But after California's worst wildfire season ever, Helfrich has had enough.
The fires were sort of a last straw for me. I've been one of those people saving and saving and saving, aspire to purchase a house in the Bay Area. And the climate migration research that I did just showed that millions of people from the southwestern United States are going to be forced to move north to Colorado and west to California. And we already see that the society around us is filled with people with guns and conflict. And so I just decided I'm going to move to Switzerland. I'm a climate migrant. I'm moving to Switzerland because it's up in the hills, right? I'm running for the hills somewhat. It's up in the Alps, insulated both from cultural and societal conflict, and it's centrally located to Western Europe. I don't want to be doing this, and I lament the feeling of necessity. And so even though I'm doing this because it's best for me, it's not that I'm doing it because I want to.
Keith Helfrich is managing director of a data consultancy company. He currently lives in San Francisco. Studies have found that Helfrich is on the bleeding edge of something that will become more common over time. A 2018 study said 1 in 12 Americans in the southern half of the country would move west and northwest over the next 45 years solely because of climate change. The ones who can afford to move, of course, and that will profoundly increase inequalities between those who leave and those who must stay in increasingly hostile areas. If Helfrich, though, is an early adopter of climate migration, Devine Lulin-Vega and Rekha Bellum are in some ways living as though the worst is already here. The two are partners, originally from Montreal. They also work together developing games as a team called 100 Rabbits. A few years ago, they decided they wanted to live as sustainably as possible, using as little energy as they could. So they bought a sailboat, solar panels, and a few batteries. They moved on to the boat, and they document how they live to inspire others to become more resilient. Here's Devine Lulin-Vega.
Our boat is a Yamaha 33-foot. The boat is older than us. Well, when we got the boat, we didn't know anything about boats. We didn't know anything about carpentry or fixing engines or anything like that, so we wanted a boat that was already working. The reason why we do everything that we do, I would probably say resilience, because to have systems that don't completely break apart is super important. We have a whole bunch of friends which we hope that they would be more resilient, but it's not like, hey, you should totally go live on a sailboat and sail around the Pacific Ocean. Like, it's not replicable, it doesn't scale. My take on this is like, the only thing that people will listen to is the law of thermodynamics. Like, when their house is on fire, then they'll be like, huh, how can I improve my system? It's really hard to sell that people are going to gain things by trying to live closer to nature. You have to be so frustrated.
The 100 Rabbits almost immediately had to adapt. When they set sail, they were designing games for iOS and realized that takes a hefty internet connection.
By the time we got to French Polynesia, we would buy like 5 gig internet cards, but then the update is 10 gigs and it has to be downloaded uninterrupted. So we would like put the SIM card in our phone, put it in a plastic bag, raise it on the mast, and then I would just try to download the update, monitor it as it downloads slowly. And as soon as the card expires, like pull the phone down, change the card, put it up again and hope it doesn't crash. If it crashes, I have to start over again. But this whole thing was just ridiculous. The breaking point is when I met another developer that was also doing that. And then we talked a bit and we're like, this is stupid. Like, I mean, we have to like change the way we work.
So how to build less power intensive software that doesn't need constant internet access and doesn't drain the tiny solar batteries they had on board? The Rabbits started writing games in Assembly, the programming language used in the 1980s to create games for Nintendo's classic NES. Those games also run on modern systems.
It seemed like a daunting task at first because it's not really well documented, but it's actually so simple. It's so beautiful. It's elegant. And there are so few parts to learn that the way I look at it sometimes is just like operating like a power tool.
Lynn Vega knows that not everyone is going to move onto a boat to use fewer resources. And not everyone is going to start coding in a language from the 80s to make games that are less power-hungry and easier to upload or download. But still, the pair wants to build some sort of a model that others could emulate if they wanted to or had to.
We're not trying to scare people. We're just trying to explore. We have the opportunity of trying some things in an environment that feels like something closer to what, post-apocalyptic life would be. But while these things are directly affecting our life, I think it has some values for the people who are affected by, California fires or people who are in a city where the grid often goes down. We see some value in trying to inspire others to try it at least.
Daveen Lulin-Vega. He's part of the software team 100 Rabbits, developing video games on a sailboat out on the Pacific Ocean. Now, adaptation on the scale of the entire planet is more than a person or a couple people or one house or one sailboat at a time. It'll take a mindset shift at the scale of companies, businesses, even global finance. Luckily, that reality is also starting to take hold. I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to How We Survive from Marketplace Tech. Coming up, how a house in Marin County, California was built to be as close to fireproof as possible, and why that might be the way of the future for all the houses in fire zones. Stay with us.
How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, strategies for investors who want to be part of the solution to global challenges, including climate change. More at impaxam.com/invest.
I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to the Marketplace Tech special, How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change. Columbia University researchers warned in April that the West might be entering a 20-year-long mega drought, and human-caused climate change is one reason why. And drought is an even bigger problem in places that have uneven access to water in the first place. In the Navajo Nation in the southwestern United States, numbers vary, but anywhere from 15% to a third of the population have no running water or access to clean drinking water. The need has been even greater since the pandemic because people need more water for hand washing and sanitation to stop the spread of COVID-19. One solution comes from the startup Source, which makes hydropanels, solar-powered panels that pull water vapor from the air and condense it into clean drinking water. A household system can produce up to 10 liters a day. It's not cheap. It costs $6,000, but private grants are funding access across the reservation. Milton So is president of the Cameron chapter in the Navajo Nation, where one family got Source panels this summer. He described the water they make.
When I was a child, when we went out hunting for small game with my grandfather, when the storm went through, you would have craters in the sandstone that held water. So we used to bend over and drink the water out of these craters, and it was pure rainwater. When I first tasted that water, I just flashed back to that part of my memory. So that's what the water tastes like, really clean and pure water, like it came from the rain.
Wow. And is it the one family in Cameron that has them right now?
Right now, yeah. People that don't have running water, some of them have to drive an hour and a half one way to town to get drinking water. People say, well, water is not expensive. Sure, if you have access to the store that's around the corner, yes, but yeah, for us the reality is that just going to the town of Flagstaff, you're spending $50 on gas and other things when you go buy water in town. A case of bottled water actually costing you around $60-$80.
How often do people have to go? Can you estimate how much a month that might cost and how much somebody is, maybe this one household is saving with the hydro panels?
I would think they would go probably 3 days out of the week to get water. But we also have folks that still rely on their livestock, sheep, cattle, horses. So they're running almost daily to haul water.
Right. More broadly, when you look at bringing infrastructure to Cameron and the Navajo Nation, hydro panels, but also like renewable energy, new electric grids, do you feel hopeful that, you know, the reservation has a chance to maybe create a new vision of energy and water that isn't so destructive?
One of the things about the climate change also is that we get more sunlight now. And I think the tribe itself has a lot of interest in renewable energy. And, you know, this energy developed in our community here in Cameron could be sold to California and surrounding states. At the same time, we also would like a smaller scale of solar energy to homes that are off the grid. That way we don't have to run more wires on our land, you know, which is such an eyesore to me. There's a price you pay, you know, and that price is not only going to be coming out of your pocket, but are you willing to sacrifice the beauty of the land to get power?
I mean, do you think that could become a model for the rest of the country and other parts of the world?
I always tell people that are interested in trying something new in Cameron, we're willing to try it here, be the first. If it works here, it'll work anywhere.
Milton So is president of the Cameron chapter in the Navajo Nation. 17 homesteads on the entire reservation now have hydro panels. Source told us it's working with the tribe to install panels on 500 more homes. The Navajo Nation story is only one example of how climate change is a problem of inequality. Environmental justice is the idea that the effects of climate change are disproportionately felt in poor countries, poor communities, and often by people of color. So building resilience can't only be about one home, one tribal chapter, one town at a time. Melissa Roberts is the founder and executive director of the nonprofit American Flood Coalition.
So folks who can afford to do things like elevate their home or pay for, you know, flood proofing or things like that will be able to protect, you know, their belongings. And those with the least means who are often in harm's way already, you know, won't be able to do those things. And that's just not a system that makes our community or our country resilient. And that just is not fair.
In fact, Robert says when it comes to flooding in particular, sometimes adaptation can make things better for one place and worse for another.
You know, water often has to go somewhere. And so when one community builds a levee kind of next to a river that can overtop and, you know, flood the community, that levee that's there will prevent the water from coming into the community it's protecting. But once it gets pushed back from that community, it can actually rebound and make the flooding worse in surrounding communities that don't have levees.
This idea that wealthier communities create adaptation measures that can actually hurt other poorer towns, well...
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. This is not a new problem.
Jalon White-Newsom works with water systems at the Kresge Foundation.
You can look over the past decades and see that it is the same communities and the same folks that continue to get the short end of the stick.
She says that systemic inequality simply won't work for climate adaptation. Because even if some people move away or some towns pay for resilience measures,
if we continue to plan in a way or think in a way, particularly the key decision makers, that we can just go ahead with business as usual, that those folks on the east side or those folks over there will deal with it, that's not going to be an answer, because ultimately this is going to be an even larger burden on society, an even larger burden on the economic line of many of these communities, because you're going to have to pay for it eventually.
Now, the type of systemic change that Melissa Roberts and Jalon White-Newsom are calling for takes policy, awareness, and also business. And big tech companies are starting to make resilience and adaptation part of their portfolios. This fall, in response to water shortages made worse by climate change and the sheer amount of water consumed by tech industry data centers, Microsoft made a commitment to be water positive by 2030. That means it will both reduce its water use and replenish water it uses. Intel made a similar pledge last year. Lucas Jopa is Chief Environmental Officer at Microsoft. He says there's a lot of opportunity for tech solutions.
One of the things that's been most exciting about the technology sector, I think, over the past couple of years is really this ability to put internet-connected sensors to be able to start saying, hey, there's not just water flowing through these pipes, we think, but there's actually X amount of water at Y time of, you know, of Z quality.
Jopa says Microsoft can use this data internally, yes, but over time, turn it into a product that other companies can use to manage their water. Because the thing about climate change is that it's a business risk that's only going to get bigger. And Jopa says this is a chance for the tech industry to do what it says it does best.
It's a societal risk. It's an existential human risk. Business is part of all of that. So it's also a business risk. It's also a huge and hugely exciting opportunity. If you are in any business right now, but technology in particular, you know, you are looking, hopefully you are inspired by bringing what makes your business special to the task of solving big, hard, gnarly problems, both because they're hard problems and you want to help, and also because if they're that big and they're that hard, then surely the rewards of solving them are going to be significant as well. You know, of course, we're trying to minimize that downside as well. Any business should be right now, but I wouldn't say that that's what drives our motivation. It's really thinking about all of these issues as one of the biggest big data problems our species has ever seen, one of the biggest compute problems our species has ever seen, one of the biggest markets that our society operates, and one of the biggest existential challenges that we've ever faced. I mean, when you look at the union of those four things and you don't see incredible excitement and incredible opportunity, I just think you need to look again.
Lucas Jopa is Chief Environmental Officer at Microsoft. Drought leads to fire, and lots of it. 2020 was the worst year ever for wildfires in the United States. In California alone, more than 4 million acres burned. Dozens died, thousands of structures were destroyed. And it's increasingly clear that we're going to have to figure out how to live with fire. Kimiko Barrett is a research and policy analyst for Headwaters Economics, a think tank based in Bozeman, Montana. She says we need to rethink how we build houses, where we build them, and even what they look like.
There's been a lot of innovation in just recent years, but there is a large component when you're starting to talk about replacement materials that are higher ignition resistance or non-combustible. There is a visual aesthetic that needs to be negotiated there with how homeowners' preference is. And so newer products are coming out to really try and mimic and look visually like that traditional building product because people don't want to lose that feel of living in a log cabin in the woods. And so now products are coming out like concrete logs that look and feel very much like a wood product. It's still kind of coming up to speed. And I think a bigger piece of it is just the outreach to homeowners that they know that these products are available. And then there is a cost comparison you have to think about and the differential cost that you're going to look at with respect to, say, a metal roof in contrast to an asphalt shingled roof.
What are the incentives that could push homeowners in that direction? Like, we see a lot of federal subsidies for things like solar. Could we start to see states or even the federal government do some kind of subsidy for more fire-resistant building?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's two big incentives. One would certainly be the fiscal piece, and that's what you're getting at with the subsidies. The other big one is just, I think, society's embracement of understanding that we are living in a very wildfire-prone landscape at this time, and that given ongoing trends, that these challenges, these risks are only going to increase into the future. We need to start thinking about how we're building differently. Homes that continually need to be rebuilt, homeowners are going to come to that point where it's a transformative event for them. They're going to want to build a home that can withstand a wildfire. And so then there's another marketing piece there that can actually be pushed, you know, of subdivisions that have been built to higher wildfire resistant standards being marketed as a community that's fire wise and that's set up to mitigate wildfire risks. And so that is another kind of educational outreach component that is yet to really reach the market, but I see a lot of value in that in the future.
Is the flip side, I mean, we know that all of this development in these wildland urban interfaces, WUIs, is a part of what's causing, you know, houses to burn down more frequently, for example. And I wonder, is there a danger if we think that we can construct fire-safe communities or fire-resistant houses that then we'll think, great, now we can build anywhere?
Absolutely. We, and I say we within the wildfire research community, would never articulate any new building or development as fireproof. That doesn't exist. And I think that needs to be recognized that you cannot build any sort of structure that's going to have total 100% fireproofness against a wildfire event. What you're trying to do is to build a home that can withstand a wildfire and build in resiliency into the actual property and landscaping itself. And so that when a wildfire does come through, you're buying not only yourself some time to collect your things and evacuate if needed, but also for firefighters to come in and suppress that fire and be very effective with the resources that they have. So that's really the idea. Certainly there is, you know, this potential devil's advocate side that, you know, it's a free-for-all given development now in wildfire-prone landscapes because you're building a home that's higher ignition resistance. But right now, we're not doing any of that.
Kimiko Barrett is a research and policy analyst for Headwaters Economics. You heard her say that there's demand for homes that are built with more fire-resistant parts. Well, we found one. In Marin County in California, just north of San Francisco, there's a brand new home that was built specifically to be as fire-resistant and self-sufficient as possible. Hardly any wood, metal trusses designed for maximum airflow, a sprinkler system, solar panels, a backup power system for when the power goes out, and it's a luxury home, to be clear. Pool, sauna, views of Mount Tam. It was listed at just under $4 million and was sold in early December. Fanny Hansen is the architect. She was born in Bulgaria and now works in the Bay Area. She gave me a tour.
This particular galley is known to be very dangerous as far as the fire. And the fire marshal made actually the greatest compliment to me by coming and saying this is the house that it has to be a standard house. And in fact, it's because also it's a sustainable material, it's recyclable completely, so you don't really lose anything. Practically with this, we did it in the shops, so there was almost zero left over and very little material that came in the site and had to be wasted.
You can almost prefabricate.
Yes, and in fact, thank you, because most of the parts are prefabricated. And now in architecture, to really be good, it is a combination of lots of parts. And those parts, if they're economical, the cost get reduced substantially. And so you can see now the trusses are very standard, used in industrial area, and very inexpensive.
Yeah, let's walk around.
Thank you. Any question, you just, you know,
oh, of course, I'll just shout it out. So what are the primary materials? Is it steel, concrete, glass? That's
pretty much it?
Pretty
much, yes. Fireplaces. So now this is the big space, and this is a space for both living, working, enjoying, playing, anything. Now, it's opens on both sides. So when you see here, the Mount Tam, which is here, of course, the landmark, and it's incredible because the view changed every time, you know. The fog comes and it just goes down and spills, and it's a painting, which change all the time.
This is an expensive house, and part of that is, of course, where we are in California. But I wonder, do you think that this kind of building can translate into other, you know, wildland urban areas where
Absolutely.
People need to avoid
but
fire?
I have to say that, in fact, I really think this is the way to build in the future, because you can use standard components and incorporate them in a creative way to respond to the need. Because the need is different than it was even a year ago. Mm-hmm. And the costs are really tremendous. So that has to be put all the parts together that could be done somewhere else and assemble on the site.
So this really could become an affordable way to build, like in new developments or for new houses.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I really think the cost of the air conditioning, only just take one component. I think majority of California has such a beautiful climate. And you can see now, you know, opening on one side, opening the other, the air goes through. You almost feel like you are in a tent and one feels 100 times better. It moves also the leaves and so on. The pattern changes and it creates incredible artistic interpretation of what really we have this wonderful world and we're just bringing in.
Plus you really save a lot of money on art. I mean, with all these big glass walls, you don't have to spend so much money.
Well, that's true because the art is outside.
Mm-hmm. Fanny Hansen is an architect based in the Bay Area. I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to How We Survive from Marketplace Tech. Coming up, fire, floods, and other disasters have another side effect. The power goes out. We'll look at how battery technology is racing to create ways to store power locally and safely. Stay with us.
How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace, is supported by Impax Asset Management, focused on the investment risks and opportunities arising from the transition to a more sustainable global economy and helping clients invest in climate change solutions. ImpaxAM.com/invest.
I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to Marketplace Tech's special, How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change. A key theme of adaptation and resilience is actually decentralization, a sort of self-sufficiency, whether that self is a house, a business, or even a city. And when it comes to energy, it means moving off one big central grid and creating little islands of power in cities, neighborhoods, and individual homes. People are doing it with solar-powered backup systems, even microgrids, little localized power plants that generate, store, and distribute power. But the key to any of those systems is that storage part. And where do you store power? Batteries. Batteries, as it happens, are also the key to electrification of cars and buses and other systems that currently rely on fossil fuels. So lots and lots of money and research is going into building a better battery. Kristen Persson and Hard Sader are working on it. They're professors of material science and engineering at University of California, Berkeley. They're also married and both work on battery technology, sometimes together, sometimes in friendly competition. Sader told me the way to think about decentralization is sort of like personal computers.
If you're old enough, you remember mainframe computers, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the utilities today are the mainframe vendors, right? And they haven't quite realize that the future is in, you know, small distributed computing. And if you look at that parallel, right, in 30 years, distributed computing has completely obliterated any mainframe computing. Even supercomputer centers today, people think of a supercomputer, but it's essentially a set of distributed computers. And of course, the grid is going to do this on a much longer time scale, and there are regulatory hurdles, and utilities themselves probably stand in the way here. But this is the future of the grid, right? A sort of dynamic marketplace of electricity between a lot of small players.
So microgrids are like the iPhones of future power. They also rely on cobalt and nickel, both of which are limited resources and with some pretty sketchy mining practices attached to them. Oh, and they're unstable, and they sometimes explode. But batteries are still really hard to improve on. Sater, for example, is working with a class of materials called disordered rock salts to fundamentally change the structure of lithium-ion batteries and the materials that make up the parts, called the cathode and the anode. That would change how the lithium flows within the battery and could increase its energy storage. But there's a lot more going on. Prepare to geek out a little.
This is really our only path forward to make, you know, 10 terawatt hour. If you listen to Elon Musk and his battery day, right, he sees the world in 2030 as generating 20 terawatt hour of battery capacity each year. To put that in perspective, that's probably about 40 times what we make today. So there is no way we can do that with today's materials. And after that, there are also other things we work on. Maybe Christine wants to talk a bit about things like multivalent technology, things that are even further out.
So I think what is useful from the battery community's perspective is that we don't work on just one possible avenue going forward. From a fundamental perspective, we don't really know what kind of hurdles there are going to be in terms of manufacturing, in terms of cost, in terms of it's a huge problem trying to project what is going to be the battery materials in lithium-ion batteries or lithium metal batteries 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. So the community is working, I would say, on a diverse set of solutions with different time scales associated with them. So for example, in the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, which is centered in Chicago in Argonne, we're collaborators, we are working on things that are even further away. For example, what if we could use calcium or magnesium multivalent ions that are shuttled between the anode and the cathode? So they are 2+, which means that if you can make that work, you can get double the capacity, so double the number of electrons for each ion that gets shuttled between them. So you sort of, there is an obvious gain there, theoretically, but there are many challenges in terms of stability of the different materials. So we are working on different kinds of materials, so figuring out how do we make these ions move in cathodes and anodes that normally wouldn't have worked.
If I may add one more quick thing. So people at Berkeley and LBNL are also working on complete solid state batteries, which is really a game changer. So today batteries contain a liquid electrolyte. It really is sort of like the old school electrolyte, right? You put two electrodes in a beaker of water and the water is your electrolyte. But the electrolyte in a lithium ion battery is actually the source of the flammability. And so people are now trying to make complete solid state batteries. So with no liquids around, and they could have potentially extremely high energy density, but they would also be, and this is important, really safe. You can gain in so many ways because you don't need all the auxiliary equipment, like to cool the batteries or to protect them if something goes wrong. And so there are sort of very multiple really important and exciting directions that the battery field is pushing in.
Right.
Maybe we should say safer. I've heard that there can be battery fires even with solid state batteries. It's just a rumor, but I've heard it.
Really? Whose lab would that have been in? I don't know. I have no idea.
I love the idea that you could be working on competing technologies too. Like, no.
Yeah, it's a friendly competition.
Oh, multivalent is the jam. Solid state is done.
Totally. They're all safe, and we're never going to have a battery fire ever again.
Never again. Kristin Persson and Hard Sater are both professors of material science and engineering at University of California, Berkeley. And if you got a little lost in all the science, the upshot is there are no simple answers to this technology, and it's going to take a while. But they told me this area of research is well-funded by both governments and companies, and there's plenty of interest in getting it right. Self-sufficiency is also a business opportunity. The startup Block Power created software to identify older buildings with inefficient heating and cooling, prime candidates to retrofit for more efficient, decentralized, or renewable fuel and energy systems. That might mean turning a building entirely electric, or building a microgrid to make its power system self-sufficient. Block Power works on commercial apartment buildings as well as single-family homes and public housing. It identifies the need and then works to train local construction crews to install the modern systems. The company operates in New York, Oakland, California, Milwaukee, and has plans to expand to many more cities. It's worked on 850 buildings in Brooklyn alone, and on a rainy day this fall in the Crown Heights neighborhood, a crew was installing an electric heat pump at the parsonage for Cornerstone Baptist Church. The building is nearly a century old.
Old school conduit, black pipe.
Oh, already?
Yeah, that's wow. What they used to use back in the day, black pipe.
The house is brick, it's four stories tall, and it has a big turret in one corner.
This is the Cornerstone Parish House, and so every pastor of Cornerstone lives here. I'm the third pastor to live here.
That's Pastor Lawrence Aker. He's lived in the parsonage with his family for 20 years. And while the home is big and beautiful, it still relies on oil heat.
It takes a lot because, and still, just to get everything heated, and then once you get everything heated, you have to turn on some air just to balance out the heat.
That's right. They have to turn on the air conditioning in the dead of winter because the oil heat makes the home too warm. And he told producer Stephanie Hughes that all that inefficient heating and cooling adds up.
Tell me about your monthly bills.
Enormous. I think just the oil bill, I think, is about $30,000 a year.
That's a lot of money.
It is.
So that's just oil?
So that's oil. So that's why you can see why we're excited about this opportunity.
Block Power, the company in charge of the retrofitting, is run by founder Donnell Baird. He says retrofitting buildings like this one is a way to build more resilient cities.
So at the individual building level, the building is more comfortable, it saves money, it uses less fossil fuels, but at the neighborhood or borough level, the entire grid is like smarter and greener and more resilient. Instead of investing $1 billion in fossil fuel infrastructure, which is expensive and not resilient, we're investing in distributed solar battery electrification projects to make the Brooklyn grid more resistant.
Baird himself grew up in Brooklyn in a family without much money. They would turn on the oven to heat their apartment. So he understands the need and the money it will take to make these changes. And in many ways, the key to that whole thing is finance.
So we've built a recommendation engine that allows a user to type in a building's address and pull up a set of preliminary recommendations on what kind of sustainability equipment should go into their building. And so we use a mix of big data, machine learning, some fancy statistics, mechanical engineering. We've built out an algorithm that allows us to make those recommendations. And so that's the software component. It helps us and utility companies and governments and building owners to determine what kind of equipment makes sense in each and every building. And then it allows us to develop a financial model of what returns to an investor or a bank might look like if they decided to finance a particular clean energy project in a particular building.
Okay, so you have the data.
Mm-hmm.
Building owners can go and look up their address and say, oh, it would cost me this much. But then you also close the loop, right? You do the retrofitting yourself?
We finance and install and project manage the project. And so for a 10-unit apartment building in the Bronx, it may cost $500,000 to replace all of their fossil fuel heating and cooling and hot water with 100% renewable energy powered energy systems. They don't have that $500,000 laying around. So we finance it. We identify and train a local mom and pop construction company. We get them trained by the manufacturer of the equipment, and we project manage the installation of the equipment that we finance.
And then where does the financing come from on the back end?
We have to negotiate with banks. And so we have a partnership with an investment bank. The New York state government has a green bank, and they've loaned us $5 million to invest in clean energy projects. And we have a new partnership with Goldman Sachs, where we're borrowing $50 million to finance projects across New York City.
And then I wonder, I'm very curious about the kind of the financial instruments that are making, you know, investments in renewable energy, for example, possible. Like, is this an opportunity for investment banks to then say, we have these green investments, even if the returns are not huge over time or take a long time?
We absolutely. So we think that there is an opportunity to develop a new asset class, right? A new mm-hmm. financial asset, a structured financial product that allows investment banks and pension funds to invest in distributed clean energy technology across America, across the world, and create a new asset class that provides them, you know, 5 to 15% rates of returns, depending on what kind of investments they make. And it doesn't correlate with the stock market. So it's an interesting new kind of investment. The fact that machine learning, cloud computing, mobile computing, the cost of those technologies has declined dramatically. The cost of solar, the cost of smart green heating systems in urban buildings has declined. That allows us to create this new asset class where banks and pension funds can finance these assets.
Got it. But it seems to me that on its face, like a 12 to 15 year return timeline is long. These are very capital intensive build outs. The returns might not be huge. So I wonder, like, it sounds to me like you have a sort of a data and this asset class play that long term could really be impactful.
Yeah, it's you can think about it as a green infrastructure bond for urban clean energy, right? So the returns will be bond-like. They're not going to be like the stock market, but they'll be stable. You as an investor are financing a particular asset out there in the real world that's going to have some financial returns. And so it's a different kind of instrument, but it could be really huge. And if you're talking about introducing environmentally sustainable technologies to the real estate sector across the world, I mean, that's just a massive investment opportunity. And so we think it's going to be a great new asset class.
Which is a super cool business for you. Does it sometimes feel like something that governments could be doing?
Well, it actually comes from the government. So I was a senior staffer for the Obama campaign, the first one. And when we won, my assignment was to work with the coalition of labor union pension funds. The idea was, how could these pension funds use federal stimulus dollars to create like green municipal bonds? But we didn't have the technology that allowed us to pull it off. So really, it is the decline in the cost of the software that we're using, as well as some significant advances in the heating equipment itself. We do hope that local municipal governments start to structure green infrastructure bonds for the Bronx or for Chicago or for Detroit.
Donnell Baird is the founder and CEO of the startup Block Power. We know that addressing climate change and investing in adaptation and resilience will take a lot of money. I believe I mentioned spending $180 billion a year earlier in the show. But increasingly, banks and financial institutions recognize the risks of not dealing with climate change and the opportunity for new financial tools and types of investment. Even Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said this fall that central bankers should consider climate change risk in assessing financial stability and even bank regulations. Hardly any part of the U.S. has not felt the climate changing. The hot days are hotter, the snowy days are snowier, the fire seasons are longer and more dangerous, the hurricanes, well, we ran out of names for them. That this extreme weather is happening at the same time as a pandemic that's upended so much about our life has shown a lot of people that the worst can happen. That things like climate changes or plagues aren't just history or forecasts or models or theories. They're part of life. It will take a massive investment to slow down global warming, but it will also take a massive investment to make cities and towns and homes and countries resilient to climate change. In some ways, as you just heard, that investment is already starting. And some of this is like boiling the proverbial frog. We might not even think of it explicitly as adaptation, but we know the weather's changing and we have to change with it. In that way, the first step is changing how we think. To think less about the seemingly unsolvable global scale problem and more about the solutions. That's how we adapt. That's how we survive. How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change, was edited by Michael Lipkin and produced by Stephanie Hughes. We also had production help from Jesus Alvarado and Rose Conlin. Scoring and engineering from Robin Edgar and Ben Holliday. Original music composed by Ben Holliday. I'm Molly Wood. This is APM.
How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, a specialist asset manager focused on the investment risks and opportunities arising from the transition to a more sustainable global economy. Impax helps investors be part of the solution on climate change and other global challenges, offering a diverse lineup of strategies that integrate environmental, social, and governance factors. Invest for impact with Impax. More at impaxam.com/invest.